What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, Eating Disorders, a Real Life Story. We're joined by Catherine Lawrence today. Catherine used to work with me here in PISD, and then she's moved on to a different district. But Catherine also has a story of a real life struggle of an eating disorder. So she's going to tell her story. We're going to talk with Dr. Carrie McAdams about some of the research that she's doing in brain mapping and using MRI to look at the imaging of the brain and how people feel before, during, and after dealing with eating disorders. And we're also talking with Jennifer Nagel. She works with one of the only doctor's offices that specializes in dealing with eating disorders. So they treat and they specialize and they're really good at dealing with eating disorders. And so we're going to get Catherine's story and then the professional advice and input of Dr. McAdams and of Jennifer Nagel. So I am Jeremy Jackson, host of the Sports Medicine Broadcast. This episode is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/eating disorder. Again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/eating disorder. All right, Catherine, welcome back. It is your time to shine. It is your turn to tell your story. So, well, you know what? It's your story. You tell it. Go for it.
All right. Well, it's actually a little bit of a long story, but I'm going to tell a little bit of a shorter version of it. I've been an athletic trainer for 12 years, and you know, one of those things is that when you're an athletic trainer that, you know, we take sometimes the least care of ourselves sometimes. And, you know, when I've told people that I have an eating disorder, it's a lot of times people say, you know, what would you tell an athlete would you tell an athlete that is sometimes with they're not eating, or if they're they come to you and say, I haven't been drinking water, I haven't been eating, what would you tell them? And I would a lot of times tell them, well, I'm not them. And that they're more important than I am, you know. Knowledge and reason goes out the door when the thoughts and feelings and imperfections are right there. You know, where the need control is something than unwanted feelings and emotion. And where the only thing that you control is this scale miles ran and the food consumed. The desire was simply to lose weight. And then the desire became to a number that didn't exist. But it wasn't where I was at. You know, one thing that I realized that, you know, eating disorders, you know, I knew are not glamorous. They're not a choice or something to be desired. Living with an eating disorder is like living with a demon that plagues every aspect of your life. These demons are vicious and will stop at nothing to tear apart your family, your relationship, your work, or your study, or everything you've ever cared for. You know, these demons have no feelings. They don't know what it's like to love and truly appreciate beauty. Because of this, they don't know what the terror of being torn apart from something so precious, and especially something that, being an athletic trainer for so many years, being torn away from that. Realizing that eating disorders are so widely misunderstood. You know, the lot of misconception is that you have to be a certain size to have one. And, you know, I was never when people think of anorexia, a lot of people think of you have to be this emaciated looking person. I never looked emaciated. I looked somewhat of a normal weight, but I was extremely sick. You know, a lot of my story started like any other story was, I started out with a new health kick. I've always struggled with body image. And started with working out. Not eating bad foods and, you know, the good food, bad food. I looked online to see what weight I was supposed to be at, knowing that it's not right. But knowing I needed a number to be reached for, looked at foods differently now as numbers they consisted of calories, fat, and sugar. You know, I went from you know, I started getting praises for how I looked. And so I thought more weight loss and more praises. You know, I tried many things like waist trainers to get my waist strong, waist smaller. And then I went so far that I hurt my back more. And then, you know, I spent a lot of times during the first time of I started during the fall of 2015, I went through the eating healthy. And then at the end of that, I hurt my back, and then I started gaining weight. And then started in February a health kick that I was going to be committed that one time. And so I was going to be committed to it, and I started being where I started restricting even more foods. Started working out, went to a new trainer, and I started out a diet of the lemonade diet, some other diets to try to do anything to try to lose the weight that I wanted to lose. And then it got so bad that in May,
Catherine.
I think that what, you know, Catherine is really saying is remarkably common. There's just such a desire that if you change yourself outwardly by diet or by exercise or by food, that can just create this, if only I did this to myself, I'd be better and I'd feel better. And that ends up creating this negative spiral whereby, that process of trying to change yourself in this way physically is pretty much impossible. You know, it's the standards in our media, you know, in performance industries, a lot of this stuff is really, it's impossible to ever get. Only a few people are going to be the most elite of the elite, right? And it's hard. There's like this balance when we're working with people that are athletes with eating disorders and figuring out what is actually physiologically healthy. And I think a lot of people have lost sight of the connection between what is actually healthy for you as a person based on your genetics, based on all of this, the biology. And when we start to enter this unhealthy state of only caring about, you know, a meal plan or a diet, you know, making a time, all this stuff, we put all the focus on that. And then even if we do succeed, it still doesn't feel good. And it doesn't feel good because the eating disorder behaviors actually traumatize the body in this way. And there's a lot of things, the obsessions, the more you think a thought, the more likely you are to think that thought again. So when you put all your focus on, if only I could do this, it becomes very hard to break this cycle for everyone. And it's often much harder for people that have invested so much of themselves in athletic endeavors because you know, you don't want to take away what the person cares about. And finding new things to care about is really the answer, finding new relationships, new hobbies, new interests, new people to be with. But that's easier said than done. It's much easier said than done. So my work really looks at how the brain changes when people go from the illness into sustained long-term recovery, to try to understand the patterns that are there. And one of the biggest problems we have is this idea that just because they're called eating disorders, it's all about these food behaviors. When often there's a dissatisfaction with a lot of things and a kind of a narrow focus that gets narrowed. And as we get older and older, you know, we limit ourselves even more to fewer and fewer outside activities, and it becomes harder to figure out what new things would add in to the world.
All right, Kat, you were telling, you're just at a point in your story where you're saying in May you started like a lemonade diet and that kind of thing. So you okay with kind of continuing your story?
Yeah. You know, and it was about in April. It was in April when I I still wasn't getting to the weight that I wanted to be at. And, you know, I saw a new trainer, and he gave me the idea of doing a lemonade diet and with the thing of jump starting my system and cleansing my body before we start this new program. And, you know, I was just more concerned about getting to the number. You know, a lot of times with through this whole thing, it's about a number, and you get to a number and then you want to get to the other number, and it just keeps on going to the next number. And you see foods as more of a good food, bad food. And that's one thing that through all the process of treatment is they teach a lot of us of seeing food as not healthy and not healthy, as more of eating foods and all foods fit in moderation. And when you signify something as a bad food, you're signifying it as having an emotion attached to it. And so I started in April and February was I was going to be committed to this one. You know, I got hurt and I was able to start working out, and I continued to I was going to be committed. And with restriction, you start having issues with when you're restricting a lot of foods, you start getting the kind of cramping your stomach. You get in gross terms, you get constipated because you don't have any things in your system to help with having everything work. And so you start getting addicted to other things to help the pain in your stomach. And so then you start taking different other supplements to help out with that. And that continued until about in May. And a lot of times with eating disorders, you switch from restriction to binging. And so in May, it turned into a binge cycle, because it was when you go into a restriction phase, your body's going to crave the sugar. It's going to crave the carbs that you're denying it. And in May, it started that way. And, you know, I had people in during the first half was telling me that I was looking sick, and or that they were asking me, you know, some people were praising me for that I looked, that they're like, oh, what are you doing? What new workout are you doing? Can you tell me what workout you're doing? And, you know, I was telling, it was like, you know, I was like, I'm not doing it right. I'm just running, and, you know, I was doing everything right. And, you know, I finally got to a size that I've never been at. So that fed it even more. And, you know, it's something when you get to an achievement, when you get to a number, you start getting that addiction even more. I started denying friendship, because you start worrying about more of when you can work out. And then you start worrying about when you go out to eat with friends of you can't control where they eat and like where the restaurant is. And so you don't want to go out to eat because you don't know where it's going to be. And so you make excuses. So you keep on going with that. And it led to laxative abuse. And then I ended up about, and it was about until May that that I had another stressor, and that, you know, like I said, turned into a binge cycle. And then and it was binge kind of purge through exercise. A lot of people, when they think of purging is vomiting. Vomiting is only one thing of purging. You know, purging through, you can purge through laxatives, you can purge through exercise, you can purge through vomiting too. So, or diuretics.
Catherine, one second. You said this, and I want to ask Jennifer, you said that people said you felt sick, or say people say are you looking sick, right? So Jennifer, what are your thoughts there? If I was to say that to Catherine, what is going on in her brain? What am I doing to her if I say, hey, Catherine, you're looking sick?
My name is Jennifer. I'm a physician assistant, and I work at the Medical Center for Eating Disorders that I co-founded with Dr. Tyson. And both of us only see people with eating disorders, disordered eating, and other forms of malnutrition. So I just wanted to say that. And it just depends on how her eating disorder will perceive that. If you say you're looking sick, her eating disorder might perceive that as you're looking thin, and the eating disorder might like that, right? So it's difficult to know how somebody with an eating disorder might take a comment, even something that might seem complimentary to them might seem negative, might come up as negative. I don't know if...
I think as a psychiatrist, if I can jump in, I think one of the biggest things is that when you say you look like this, you're saying that your appearance matters to the person as well, right? And so they're not going to conceptualize it as I need to see a doctor necessarily. You know, we really want people with eating disorders to get to recovery. We have to really change their perception of what they believe other people think about them to be not related to appearance, not related to performance metrics, but more as, you know, so saying things like, you look really excited today, you look really happy about that, did you win a prize, did you, you know, is there something in your life that matters? We're trying to help broaden this. This is one of the hardest things in working with patients that get consumed by the illness, is that there's very few things in their life during the illness that matter. And trying to help them find that is a long therapeutic process that we kind of go through with either psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists, LPC, to really help broaden their understanding of what matters to them and to help that get a footing again. And that is the slowest and hardest part, I think, of treating the illness, is getting the person because they recognize that these thoughts are not functional, they're not helping them. But figuring out how to think differently is really a challenge over time. And it's easier for me to work with someone that has a profession that they're proud of, interested in, that is not sports, performance, appearance, fashion related. Because all of those kinds of jobs, there's so much focus on your time, your appearance, all of that stuff. It's very hard to think other things matter, like being a kind person, being nice to the, you know, supporting the people you're working with, enjoying the time with people.
I want to make a comment and I have a question. So the comment is, I think it's difficult because you don't know. If I don't know that she's got something going on with her and I say, you look good, I don't realize I may have just stressed her out. And so it's really, really tough. It's almost like when somebody loses a loved one, what do you say to them besides, I'm sorry for your loss? There are no good words at some point, and you don't know that you may be potentially doing harm to that individual mentally with that being said. So, you know, and I get it to an extent, but that's really, really difficult to compliment someone, and all of a sudden that compliment was taken the wrong way because of the way that their chemistry is going at that moment.
So I think this is where in psychiatry, we learn a lot about using I language. So I'm happy to see you is saying something about you and not something about them. And that kind of language is not as much about what they look like, what they're doing. You know, it's about I take joy in spending time with you. You know, that's what we want people to sort of take away from that and to say, you know, did you enjoy going to this event? If you know someone went, you know, did you see a lot of trick-or-treaters last night? Like those kinds of things that are not so much about like, what was your funniest costume, right? This is taking the mindset off the person and into the actual world of being with other people. That's kind of where we put our focus on helping our patients and family members working with patients with eating disorders, just to talk about your own feelings in relation to the person and activities that you can both kind of agree on that are not related to that. Oh, you look good. I'm happy to see you is so much more of a compliment to someone than what they look like.
Well, and that makes perfect sense after the fact of knowing, but if you don't know, you don't realize.
But it's true for everyone, right? Yeah, it's true. So that is a cultural language that we are used to critiquing other people's appearances and performance. And so it's a cultural shift, but it helps. Everyone likes that. Everyone likes you talking about how you feel about them if it's in a positive way.
Right. You know. Okay. So my other one is we know that the Cosmo magazine and Victoria's Secret models are not the norm of a healthy, quote-unquote healthy individual. But from a medical standpoint, does the old height-weight chart that everybody depends on, is that a bad thing too? Because, I mean, if you look, let's take J.J. Watt. If you look at him on a height weight chart, he's probably morbidly obese, but the dude's cut like Adonis. He's not unhealthy. And does that play a role somewhere down the line?
Jennifer, what do you think?
So the BMI chart is, it puts men and women on the same chart, which I think is not appropriate. And so you're correct. People with really high muscle mass can be perceived as obese or morbidly obese even when they're not. So I don't think that's the best indicator. And I know that the schools use it and they give out report cards sometimes. And I think that that can be detrimental, especially to people that are at risk for eating disorders. So I don't think it's a good indicator.
Well, I mean, their pediatricians are looking at them when they go into the office and saying, you know,
95th percentile.
Right. You're at this percentile or you need to drop 5 pounds. But, you know, they're looking like an unhealthy individual already, and they're going, you need to drop more. I mean, I'm diabetic, and they did the same thing to me when I was diagnosed. You need to drop 10 more. If I dropped 10 more, I'd have been in the hospital. And so, you know, and I'm not that tall in the grand scheme of things. So I just don't, you know, I just think my personal opinion is it does play a part, and we need to go back to something I guess we've all looked at, and it's probably wrong too, was, you know, a body fat percentage or some other method of looking at it, saying how are, you know, what are we defining as a healthy body?
Well, I'm right. Gonna.
It's not cookie cutter. Our weight is pretty much determined by genetics. And so, right. In this situation, I think talking to an experienced dietitian that can help with taking into account body frame and muscle mass and genetics and all of that to help you determine what your healthy weight range is for your body, not putting it against anybody else's, mm-hmm. is the best thing to do.
All right, Kat?
Well, you know, when people were telling me that they were concerned, it was more of a lot of times, even all the way until I went into residential, and we'll get to that, in February, that I fought them tooth and nail because I had the conception that I had it under control and that pretty much what I saw in the mirror was not sick and that I was looking fine. I was maintaining both my job and my eating disorder together, and I wasn't willing to give up both. And the whole thing, I mean, I fought a lot of people when they would say, you look sick. And that, I told them that they were being over-exaggerating that because, again, I knew that you have your part of your brain that I have from being an athletic trainer, having gone through school, is that I knew that I was looking that way, but I was in my head, I had it under control. And I had in my head that a person that was suffering with restriction and everything else had a certain body type that I didn't look like I was emaciated. I wasn't looking like I was a frail skin kind of person. So I didn't need to go away. I didn't need treatment. I was doing it. I was fine. I was in control. And that, so when people were starting to do that, I got in a lot of fights with a lot of people, and that made me even more wanting to isolate from people because of that. And, you know, a lot of times when you guys were talking about weight, a lot of the other things that threw, and we'll get to all that, was that, a lot of the body image, there's a lot of things that through 2 years of treatment, that realizing it through reading and everything else, that was just a symptom of a deeper problem. That body image and getting to an ideal body looking, that's a symptom to a deeper problem that I had. And so when people talk about body image, that's just a symptom. I mean, there's the deep control of what I was wanting, and that was a part of it.
Okay, so So you're kind of at the point to where you're talking about going away.
No, I'm on my first round of treatment.
Okay.
I've gone through, this is my second.
Yeah, I was just wondering, you said you were fighting with people, you were denying it. Me as an athletic trainer, what are some of the things that I should have seen in you, you know, if I was interacting with you daily, that would have indicated that I needed to, you know, use some, like Dr. McAdam said, some, you know, hey, how are you feeling? Or I feel like, you know, this kind of thing, some of those non-attacking words. So what are some of the things that you feel like would have indicated to me?
Can I jump in? I think you're asking the wrong individual. We need to ask the lady on the screen right now.
All right, so Dr. McAdams.
Because I think the problem is for us in our profession, if I see her every day, I don't notice the change per se. You know, what do you... Well, we know of an individual that
Let's hear what Dr. McAdams
says. Well, I know,
says.
But I mean, let me just finish. Because I think if I don't see you for 3 months and all of a sudden you look totally different, that's a different animal than I've seen you every day and I don't notice the change, if that makes sense.
But I'm going to go, is that you... That as athletic trainers of seeing is I think it's a whole thing of educating our coaches and seeing that our coaches being educated of what they see is that I think more education for coaches because they will notice what they are doing on how they're performing and how they're interacting with the kids and are their other, you know, teammates. And they're going to see that stuff first. And then they're going to bring it up to you. And they're the first one. And, you know, talking to and knowing when I have had a lot of coaching support through all this, that a lot of them are very much scared, you know, a lot of them, you know, they're very much thing. And I think it's the whole thing of being very much scared of this illness, scared of mental health.
Can I say a couple things? So in terms of what an athletic trainer might observe, probably you might notice drastic weight changes. Maybe they're getting ill more frequently or they're getting injured more often. You might start to notice extreme fatigue or lethargy. They might be dehydrated, not drinking fluids. If they're complaining of any dizziness or fainting, underperformance, if they're not really measuring up to where they had been and all of a sudden they're declining performance-wise. If they start to express an intense fear of weight gain or they start talking about body dissatisfaction, if they're focused on weighing themselves, measuring their body fat, any drastic change in what they're eating, restriction of food or dieting, and a preoccupation with food or calories, recipes, and then any other unusual eating habits and food rituals that sort of appear all of a sudden. So those are all things that you might see. And I don't know if Dr. McAdam would have anything else to add.
Yeah, so from the psychiatry side, I think one of the, I see a lot of patients that don't really believe they have an eating disorder either because they haven't reached their goal weight and they come in and they're having symptoms. So the kinds of symptoms that are indicative of sort of a starvation state or an undernourished state include insomnia, not enjoying things you used to enjoy. So if you're athlete used to be the life of the party and wanted to organize social events. The eating disorder is associated with withdrawal because when we're starving or undernourished, we want to just crawl up in a hole and stay home and we don't want to be seen by other people. So with wearing, like never being warm is a sign of a physical sign. But typically when someone comes to see me, they will often say they're recovered from their eating disorder, but they have residual symptoms of concentration, insomnia, fatigue, energy, and they go through their diet and they're eating very little, right? They're just drinking coffee in the morning, things like that. So I think as coaches, as athletic trainers, the literature does not really give people enough protein. Typically, athletes that I see that develop the eating disorders go through, first they're vegetarian, then they're vegan. And that's an easy way to eliminate a lot of foods. It's a good excuse to not eat the barbecue at the party if you're suddenly vegan and you're just eating pickles. That's a great calorie reduction. So, but from my side, I think the motivation to change, people seem to be most motivated if you say, I feel like, you know, you seem like you're sad. It seems like you're not enjoying school anymore. Are you still enjoying being on the team? Those kinds of questions are about feelings and are hard for people with the eating disorder to answer, but they're also not the questions that they expect from people, from their coaches, from their performance, you know. So I usually feel like wanting to change that and trying to remind the person of what they used to be like you used to always be the person at the dance. You used to always want to, you know, stay late, not make curfew, you know, now you're, you know, in bed 2 hours before, you know, you're supposed to be at the hotel, you're complaining. So that irritability, and commenting on that stuff rather than the eating disorder stuff is so shameful for everyone, because it seems like once you know there's a problem with eating, you should be able to fix it. It should be really easy to just stop laxatives, stop the overexercise, stop the purging, eat more food at the meals. It seems like on the face of it, and this is the hardest thing with working with the families of people with eating disorders, it seems like once you know it's an eating disorder, I mean, we see this all the time. I didn't know I had an eating disorder. Now that I know I have an eating disorder, I'll be like fixed in a week because I'm just going to get my new meal plan and follow that. And it's actually extremely difficult to make these kinds of changes because it took a long time to get to the illness. These illnesses don't occur overnight. They don't occur, you know, the first time someone purges or the first time they decide I should try this fad diet. It's doing it every day for months. And that's part of why it's so shameful, because then it becomes a shaming thing. And so focusing on concentration problems, fatigue, these activity changes with friends and teammates, those are the kinds of comments that I think might motivate someone to go see someone more than you should stop purging, you should eat more. Like those kinds of comments sound like they should work, but if that worked, this wouldn't be an illness, the severe illness that it is.
Yeah,
that's,
I mean,
so hard.
I mean, you know, having had a dealing with the mental health and having the whole thing of mental health, it's very much very shameful of saying I have a mental health illness, and that's one of those things that you keep hidden because you don't want people to know. And especially being an athletic trainer, you feel like, okay, I have the knowledge and skills that I knew exactly when I was taking different things and I was doing different things that I was damaging my body. And so me letting that out, I was being very much of like contradicting what I went to school for and how I treat athletes and how I've been doing for a long period of time.
So you kind of had this internal battle going on.
No, yeah, I mean, but then it was one of those things, I mean, like Dr. McAdam said, that when people were talking to me about, okay, I want the old me back, they were asking that, I was still saying I was fine. I had it under control. I mean, that was more closer to my second relapse, that when I relapsed the second time.
All right, so let's kind of continue along with your story.
Yeah.
Okay. Hang on, because I'm gonna get to part of this. We've known each other a day or two in the grand scheme of things, like almost 20 years. But anyway, at what point did you realize you weren't managing your eating disorder, you weren't handling your daily duties at work, and that you actually had a problem? You have the stressor that starts this. What was the aha moment that said, I got to get help?
Well,
let me rephrase it. I've got to get help is one thing, but when you finally admitted, yes, there's an issue, I think that's a different answer altogether.
That I realized there's like many different aspects that, because you go through, a lot of people think of eating disorders as a okay, it's you go through, it's right, then it's like black and white of when you're ready to go for recovery. It's like you go through different phases of where you're fully committed to getting better, and then, or you still want to like hold on to different things. And I think that when I was dealing with the first time that I went into treatment, I wasn't ready to fully give it up. I was somewhat in the ready to go get help. I think I was realizing when my mom said, when I finally admitted to my mom that I had a problem, that I knew I had a problem, that I was ready to go, but I don't know if I was fully committed to doing everything needed. And so, and then I guess when I was saying, so to answer your question, I think to realizing I really did have a problem, I needed help, was when I was sitting with my principal and one of the coaches that has been the biggest supporter through all this, two of the coaches that, and they said, it's time. You've pushed it too far and it's time. And then I still I pushed it up because I still had, you know, pushed them even more of saying, I just want one more week, because I already had in March had a, or when like in January of this year had a time that I was going to go, that I knew I needed help. I knew I needed help, but the true like willingness to go full off ready for recovery was probably when I actually stepped foot on the plane and when I left to go to California in March of this year.
Was that a realization at that point that this is actually real and happening?
Yeah, because when you're leaving to go to a city that you really didn't ever hear of, and to knowing that you're going to be there for a couple of months, and that you were leaving a second time, and that it was time, that it was like, that you realize it's done, you know, that's a big thing. That was a huge, stepping on that plane was the hardest step on the plane that I've ever taken.
Is it, so I'm going back to our doctors and PAs on the screen here then for this part of it. Is that like an alcoholic that has to stand up at an AA meeting and say, I'm so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic, and they have to do that every week? Is it similar in the mindset of going and getting well, so to speak, if that makes sense?
Well, I mean, there's a similarity in addictions and eating disorders, but honestly, I think the eating disorders are really much harder, because so much of what causes the eating disorder is really culturally ingrained in what our society values and wants, which is kind of this objective performance. And the other thing is that everybody always has to eat, right? You don't have to do drugs. You don't have to drink, but you have to figure out how to successfully eat while thinking as little as possible about eating, because you need to start filling up your head with other stuff. And it's that eating and body image and what I look like is what matters to other people, all that stuff. It takes a long time to help people develop, regain kind of the sense of self-worth. And at this, simultaneously, the eating disorder has created a trauma really to the brain. Like our brain is 2 pounds. If we do nothing all day, the brain is using 30% of the glucose. It can only get energy from glucose. So this is something that is not widely understood. Like if we don't have a constant supply of glucose to our brain, we're hurting our ability to learn. We're hurting our ability to change. And this is not as common with other addictions, right? So in the eating disorder, we actually damage the part of the body that enables us to change and overcome the illness. And it's very common that people are like, well, I'm willing to stop my purging behavior as long as my weight doesn't go above X. And so it's very common for people, there's a dysphoria, I'm willing to stop the binging, because if I don't binge, I won't purge. There's this sense of, I'll give up some of the behaviors, but giving up all of the behaviors makes our patients wonder what is left, because sometimes that the illness has been very consuming. And certainly for athletes that might not be able to go back to their sport, that's a problem as well, right? Like if they have a performance sport, figure skating or gymnastics, or you know, sometimes running is very repetitive. It's hard for people to, and the physiological responses of the exercise, you know, also can suppress appetite and can make us insensitive to hunger cues. And so the signals of when I should eat, how much I should eat, all of that gets really confused in the eating disorder. And so we generally do see patients, particularly younger patients, the in high school, they often don't want to give up a lot of the illness. They'll give up parts of the illness. It takes a long process to get to recovery. That's what we've really been trying to understand, is how do you change how you think about yourself? How does the brain change that in people when they recover from an eating disorder, and when they're having an eating disorder and different kinds of symptoms, how does that relate to self-perception?
Yeah, I mean, you go through and, you know, it's not just a day by day. It's sometimes it's meal by meal, and, and knowing, you know, it's still where you have to think about when you don't have hunger cues, of thinking, okay, it's 12 o'clock, I need to eat lunch. And then looking at, I mean, when I was fresh and to recovery, or well, when, and you know, we'll get to back to the story, but where you have to, when you look at a plate and you start, I mean, I started to, when I was in going through the working out and everything, I mean, I could, because I had the calorie app, I could know exactly pretty much about how many calories were in each kind of dish, and where you start doing all the different math, and I started knowing because I had an app that I knew exactly somewhat around what kind of each run would be, which each workout would be. And you start playing math games, you know, that I didn't know, I'm horrible at math, but you start playing, your life becomes about numbers. And it's all because of numbers. It's all about numbers. And that's a hard thing. And it's the hard thing that you also, a lot of people don't realize is that, that people expect sometimes, and again, we're going back and forth, but like that you go into treatment and you come back fixed, recovery is very much a linear thing. It's like you keep going, and it's one thing straight up, and that's how recovery goes. And that's where there's a flip on the switch that, okay, you just decide to, that you don't have that problem with looking at a dish of food, and you don't have a problem knowing what's in that food. It's more of a loop-de-loop kind of things, and where you have like good days and you have bad days. And, you know, I have good days and I have bad days now. But the hard thing is you still battle having the shame of, if you have a bad day, of, can you have a bad day? Because you want to prove to everybody that you're going forward, and that a little step is okay. And it's not that it's okay to have like, can't be perfect. But, you know, I always suffered with dealing with all of this is having something control. And when, you know, when I was in residential, that we had to write out as many reasons to recover, reasons for recovery. And, you know, we wrote down all these reasons, and some of those are really hard reasons, like where, you know, like Dr. McAdam say, you want number one, but okay, number two's pushing it. and number three, you know, and you keep going. And it was hard to take all 100 of them. And because that's like, that's holding something that you have held on so tight that giving that up is giving up a lot of control. And that's kind of letting everything go and letting your brain kind of like figure things out. And that's hard. That's hard work. And again, because you, it's not just, okay, go eat and go look at food differently. And it's okay to have, you know, a lot of times people associate, okay, you know, it's okay to go have cake not on at a birthday, you know. It's okay to have treats, not, you know, it's okay to have treats. And so that's, I mean, that's something that I dealt with for, I mean, I still deal with.
All right. I want to ask you two things off of this. Because one, she was talking about it just a minute ago. So, and you made mention. So you exercised, mm-hmm. okay, and exercise suppressed your appetite. So by doing that and knowing, hey, I just ran X number of miles and I'm not really hungry, and I'm losing weight, did that encourage you to go exercise more because you were going to lose more weight, if that makes sense the way I'm saying that? Was it a vicious cycle between the two? I'm exercising, I'm not hungry, so I'm going to keep exercising because I'm not hungry and I'm losing weight. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
It was both, but it was also a, you know, is a competitive factor too.
Right, but I'm looking at it from what we talked about.
Oh, yeah, about losing weight. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was more of a... It started out that way. Yeah. Yeah. Because you start again, I became a pro at math and a little bit where you look at deficit, caloric deficit was something that was a goal to be achieved. And the bigger caloric deficit, the greater the achievement. And right. If you could handle your caloric deficit and still be functioning, that was an achievement because you were doing it right. And
well, I'm looking at it also, you go back to what can the athletic trainer do? Well, I've got the kid now that's doing extra workouts on their own is probably a huge two red flags. One or two every now and then is one thing, but all the time would be huge red flags for, you know, maybe something's going on to pay attention to. But the other thing you talked about, rehab and recovery and going to treatment, I look at this, I think, from use the athletic trainer side for a minute, similar to what we deal with all the time. You just had somebody had surgery for their ACL, for instance. That's the easy part is having surgery, right? The hard part's the next 9 months of working on your own away from your teammates to get better, and knowing you're going to have setbacks with that is going through what you're going in a similar vein of that, if that makes sense. You're kind of out there on your own. You've got to do your thing to get better, but it's not within the crowd of people, if that makes sense.
Well, with ACL, you kind of know in 9 months that you're going to be done, you know. with eating disorders, it's a chronic thing.
But you got to put in the work for both.
You got to put the work in both. But with ACLs, you can see, feel, and touch the change. And that, you know, eating disorders are expensive too. And that you start, that it's a chronic thing. It's a chronic illness that it doesn't go away in a year. That you have a treatment team that's with you for years, and that it's starting to move through the phases of recovery.
Can I say something? In terms of onset of illness, if the eating disorder is discovered earlier, the better the prognosis and the shorter the duration of illness. We know that. But the other thing I want to talk about is when we were talking about the exercise and the weight loss and wanting to exercise more. So a couple of things came up for me when we were talking about that. One is, if the body's not taking in enough fuel, how is it able to exercise like that? And where is it getting the energy to do that? And the answer is, basically it uses its own resources. So it starts breaking down muscle for energy and liver and organ tissue and brain mass and pretty much anything that it can to be for the person to be able to continue that exercise. And during exercise, specifically anaerobic exercise, you can produce lactic acid, which in situations where there is starvation and malnutrition, the brain can use lactic acid for fuel. And so you might see in athletes this drive to exercise as a way to fuel their brain because they're not eating enough.
So, I mean, I think we all kind of understood you somewhat cannibalize yourself to lose weight, but with an eating disorder, you're truly cannibalizing yourself because it's taking any energy source available to keep doing what we're doing.
Correct. And that there may be an actual physiologic drive by the brain to derive fuel from that anaerobic exercise, from that lactic acid produced
right.
to the brain, because it's not getting glucose, at least not the amount of glucose that it needs.
Go for a run so I can survive, in essence. I mean,
correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. One of my friends that does animal work kind of talks about it as like if there's no food and we're in evolutionary system, then we want to go find food. So there's a sort of a promotion of exercise, you know, in seeking feeding options that can be pathological and might contribute to some of this like exercise rather than eat approach. But I think I want to kind of go back to what Catherine was saying about sort of this as a chronic disease or as a long-term illness. I have kind of made a lot of effort to find people that have recovered from anorexia nervosa in particular, but as well as bulimia nervosa, but kind of this long-term sustaining process of recovery. And then we've done the brain imaging work to look at the differences in the brain when they recover. Some of the interesting findings says that the people, when you're sick with the illness, you're almost in denial about the symptoms. And so when you ask people, how much are you thinking about eating or how much are you worried about your body? Sometimes people that are very sick say, I don't do that at all. And then people that are recovered are much more aware of the fact that they are doing it, because the recovery process, you know, going through recovery means you become aware of things you didn't even know were eating disorder behaviors. So it's actually been kind of interesting to me that the people I personally, as a psychiatrist, as a researcher, that's kind of found these people that are very well recovered. I feel like the most recovered people are most aware of the residual symptoms, and they then have strategies to overcome them. But they don't really. It would be very difficult for me to do a study where I said I only want people recovered from the eating disorder, because I wouldn't get anyone. The people that are, in fact, in my opinion, as a psychiatrist, pretty well recovered, are aware of the distortions they might have with regard to compliments or eating disorder symptoms, or the residual sort of anxiety or depression that may have initially predisposed to developing the illness to begin with. And the people that are the most sick are the least aware of their eating disorder symptoms. They say, I never worry about what I look like. I never think about food. I never think about my body image. I just forget to eat. This makes this illness, it's been a real challenge. The literature is a challenge. There's not kind of standardized definitions of recovery, because I think everyone with the illness would like it to just go away. We would like it if you could go to treatment and it would just be gone, because now you are following a meal plan. But if you're actually putting effort into following your meal plan and making sure you don't go too long without eating, because then that makes you more likely to binge on junk or things like that, if you're actually thinking about it in a way that facilitates recovery, you might feel like you're still in the illness even when you're not. And then there are people that sort of hold on to symptoms. I saw someone this week who, you know, hasn't been underweight for 20 years, but he still weighs himself every day, you know, and that's a sign. He still weighs himself every day and he won't eat breakfast, you know, and it's really, those are signs of the illness persisting in a low grade kind of, you know, I can work, I can do stuff, I can function, but
that's something I don't want to glance over.
I don't want people to think recovery is impossible. We want them to think recovery is possible, but with recovery comes a better understanding of who you are and what matters to you, and that may make you more aware of things that are considered eating disorder behaviors and eating disorder cognitions and things like that.
that's something I don't want to just glance over. So often, from what I understand, the majority is females, but there are males with eating disorders as well. And so it's not, I just need to, you know, be looking for the females that are looking, you know, extra skinny or avoiding and that kind of things. There's also males.
And most commonly with the males, there's a lot of over-exercise in the illness.
Well, we now have the male athlete triad, you know, that it was always exclusively the female athlete triad. And it's, that's now reared its head in the last few years.
I think the statistics are that there are more males with eating disorders that are athletes than females. And they tend to, it can hide a little bit better because they can be at a higher body weight because they have more muscle tissue. And so they can get away with it longer. And so they now call it the relative energy deficit in sports instead of the female triad. And this is when there's not enough fuel, adequate fuel, then the body will preserve calories and redirect energy to essential body functions. And eating disorders medically affect every organ system, and it also affects athletic performance for sure. And I think it's important also to talk about eating disorders are not a choice. It's not something that anybody really wants to happen. Most of the time it happens by accident. Like, it starts out with, I'm just going to lose a pound or two, or I'm just going to try this diet. And I think that it might actually help my performance. It might help my athletic performance. And then it just sort of slides out of control. And then they don't even realize that it's out of control. And it kind of can happen, you know, so sort of progressively, but slowly over time, that even the people around them don't really notice it, shockingly. Right? It's not something that sort of hits them over the head. It's sort of something that you get to a certain point down the illness, and then all of a sudden it's like, we have a problem. But it's never been anything that any of my patients have ever said, you know, I woke up one day and decided I wanted to have an eating disorder. It's almost like they didn't even really realize that it was happening.
Yeah, I mean, I could find a lot of different things that I could spend my money on than paying for the amount of doctor's visits and the amount of treatment that I've been spending on for the past 2 years. Because, I mean, the hard thing is that a lot of people don't know that eating disorder physicians like, you know, Jennifer Nagle, that, and like a lot of people, there's not a lot of therapists and dietitians that are on insurance. That there's not a lot of them around, and it's a hard thing when it's a chronic illness where you have to see your team, and let's just say, like, I have to see every week, I have to see my dietitian and my therapist. And that can, you know, everybody's got to do that, plus pay your bills and pay your rent. And that can wear on your budget.
You're in education. You're not rich.
Yeah. And so that's a lot of money. And, you know, I mean, and going back to how the story kind of goes back, I mean, In May, after spring football, I went to PHP, which is primary hospitalization, for 5 weeks. And then I went to intensive outpatient. And again, like you said, I wasn't willing to give up everything. Like, I was still holding on to the fact of my worth was in how I looked. And I didn't want to give that up. And so then I decided, you know, I got to go back to running. And once I got back to running, that's when I started started cheating on my meal plan. Once I started going back to work, I started busying myself out of eating. And then I started cheating on the amount of food that I was following my meal plan a little bit. And then I started getting, you know, we started doing restriction amount of working out at first, of how much I got to work out. And then that got annoying. And so I started pushing the envelope on that, because going 10 minutes on the bike for 5 miles, 5-minute little slow little pace for someone that was very much competitive too, that was I could have used my time doing something else than doing that. And if I was going to work out, I was going to go work out. And so once I started running 3 miles, it started becoming 6 miles. And then I started busying myself out of eating at times. And then that progressively got worse. And then, started with the amount of miles that I ran. That I started running during the fall. I ran a lot of miles. And then when you start started restricting and started getting back into the abuse of laxatives. Cause again, when you restrict from foods, you don't have the fuel in your, when I was malnourished, that your stomach hurts. Your stomach hurts a lot because there's nothing in there to help with that. You start hurting a lot. And that because you're not having enough fats and fats and everything else to help. And, that continued because then that the amount of working out kept on going. And then you get to a point, like Jennifer's saying, that you get like there was a big, there's time where I could run a lot. And then I was taking a lot of energy drinks and a lot of different things because I started getting exhausted. I started getting exhausted closer as the time went on. And because I was so tired and started taking more energy drinks because and high intensity and started with, taking thermogenics because I was A, not losing the weight that I wanted to lose, and B, I was so tired. And so that was a little bit that led to again, my body tapping out. I started back then, I started taking, there was an amount of supplements that you start adding to your body that I started adding my body in the fall and into the spring. And, and the working out, like my body tapped out in January of the amount of working out.
Okay. We're kind of ending our time here. I know Dr. McAdams, I believe, said she had to go at a certain time point. She has another meeting. So Dr. McAdams, Jennifer, why don't you guys give us real quick just a last thought on eating disorders and then also a way for somebody to reach out and get a hold of you if they want to find out more. So Jennifer, why don't we start with you?
So I think it's important from a medical standpoint to note that there are no organ systems that are spared in malnutrition from an eating disorder. Literally from the tip of your toenails to the tip of your hair can be affected. And if you suspect that someone you know or yourself even might have an eating disorder, it's important to have the medical aspects looked at by somebody that specializes in eating disorders. In addition to that, a dietitian that specializes in eating disorders, a psychiatrist that specializes in eating disorders, and also a therapist that specializes in eating disorders to help address all of the different aspects of an eating disorder. It does take a team, and recovery is possible. Like I said in the beginning, I am a physician assistant, and I co-own the Medical Center for Eating Disorders in Houston with Dr. Tyson. And you can find us on the website, on the internet at www.medforeds.com, M-E-D, the number 4-E-D-S.com, like medforeatingdisorders.com, if you want to learn more about what we do. And thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Dr. McAdams?
So I'm an assistant professor at UT Southwestern in Dallas, and our research email, so we are actually looking for adult women that have had symptoms of either anorexia or bulimia in the last year. And so we're not trying to say how sick you are right now. We're just looking for people that have had the illness. And so we do neuroimaging studies and genetic studies, looking at kind of how the biology affects our perception in our brain. And I think that's an important thing because that this process of starvation and restriction of food, as well as the binging and purging, it changes how people respond. The easiest way to get in touch with me is through the UT Southwestern. You can email me directly. Our research email, if you're interested in hearing more about our studies, is actually edresearch@utsouthwestern.edu. So it's just edresearch@utsouthwestern.edu. And we are happy to hear from anyone. And this is a 5-year study from the National Institute of Mental Health. And we are hoping to really understand how the symptoms relate to the perception that the patient has. And I think that's the key thing in working with your athletes and your friends and family with the illness, is to recognize that this illness does distort how they perceive themselves, how they perceive other people. And it's not just about the body image. It's hard. It's a hard thing. And it takes a long time to get it. And it takes a lot of work to recover. But we do also agree that recovery is possible. It's just not an overnight process. There is no magic. There's no magic. There's no medication. There's no specific thing you can do and it'll be gone tomorrow. It takes a lot of work and consistency with the same treatment team throughout the recovery process. So,
very good.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
This is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/eating disorder. Again, I have Dr. McAdams' whole CV there, her whole bio, a linked in there. So it's got contact information. I've got contact information for Jennifer Nagel there in the show notes. So if you didn't catch them saying that, or you wanted to look up some more, I have links to that there. So hey guys, thanks for joining us. And it appears that this is a topic that we're gonna have to hit up again, because I think we only got about halfway through what we needed to. All right, so we're currently in the Marvel Comics mode right now. This is the extended scene that you wait for afterwards. So
the credits have rolled.
Yeah, yeah. So, Catherine, I know that we kind of jumped in and out, and hopefully that helped calm you down. I know sharing the story, whenever I had to share the story of our kid passing, it was tough. And, you know, you get broken up and that kind of thing. And so I believe that sharing your story is good for you as much as it is good for other people to hear, because obviously you're not the only person dealing with this. So I wanted to make sure that you had a chance to share any more of your story that you didn't get to or you wanted to just add in here.
Well, I mean, the main thing, I guess, was that I didn't get to, we didn't have time to finish, was that I didn't get, once my body tapped out, and that I started going even more downhill, and that it took a lot out of me, but it was one of those things that in the spring I kept going, and that it was more of, I had so many people that were there for me, but when you start going after your body and you started, your worth was more in a number than it was and looking what you're doing in your body, that was the hardest thing. And the main thing is that I guess telling my story is more of saying to people that it can happen to anybody, and that that I had some people that I was truly blessed to have, like a school that wrapped their arms around me, and a principal that had my back, and that this is a constant road, and it's one of the hardest roads that I've been on, but I've had some people that have truly embraced this. And, you know, I guess one of the scariest things is that the everything that I put my body through is realizing the residual damage that is still going on, that I'm trying to do still the right thing, but there's still consequences and there's still damage that is done that still needs healing.
When you were going through the process of the eating disorder, full-blown symptoms, did the damage to your body ever cross your mind?
No.
So your back's hurt, you're doing all this stuff, you're like, it's just what it is, and you never thought that A plus B plus C is equaling whatever? It never crossed your mind?
No. When I passed out, I mean, in February, I ended up at home. I mean, because of orthostasis happened a whole lot more in February. And, you know, I would lie to people during, I mean, if it happened where I was just getting up too quickly, I mean, I never passed out at work, but like, if I got up too quickly and I got a little dizzy, it was more, I tell people, oh, I just got up too quickly. But the times that I actually passed out by myself, that it was, I discounted it. Oh, well, that was due to medication. That was due to taking laxatives twice in a row and not eating and not drinking enough water. I just won't do that again. And then I was mad the third time when I got, and that's when they brought in, a friend brought in one of my rocks, one of my close, you know, that brought in the cavalry and said, it's time to go. That I still got in a fight with them of saying that that was, that I knew what I did wrong. So, okay, let me stay one more week. Okay. I told you I was going to leave on the 10th. Let me stay one more week. I knew what I did wrong. Knowing very well that I was doing everything wrong. And so you don't, you know, I knew, but you have that little invisibility factor. I knew when I went into the supplement store and the guy told me that this thermogenic was banned, but it was the best one for weight loss.
Then give me two boxes.
That I took it, or when I was taking 20 plus pills of supplements of different kinds in the spring, that in freaking out if I missed one, or in taking and chewing multiple packs of gum because I wanted to suppress my appetite, that was okay because I still was functioning. And my idea of functional was,
you were upright.
I was upright, and I was still doing my job, and that I was okay. But I think the hardest thing was coming home. That was the hardest thing. Going to residential was hard, but coming home was the hardest thing, because you're coming home thinking you're plopped down back into a world that has been going on without you. And you're going back to realizing that you caused a lot of damage while you were sick. And you're coming back home to a new body, with a new body that you had to weight restore. And you're coming back to realizing that you're back in the environment that caused it. You're back in the environment of trying to prove to people that you worked hard in residential. I mean, I was in residential for 2 months, and I was in a wheelchair for a month because of orthostasis. And that is something that, like, you try to prove yourself, but then you have people that want to say to you that you caused damage, and you caused a lot of time where people took their time of their day to try to take care. So you don't want to be a burden, and you want to prove to people that you're right. But you still caused a lot of hurt and a lot of pain and a lot of damage to people. And that's the hardest thing. That's the hardest thing, is coming home and knowing that the world around you, because you're protected at residential. The eating disorder is a way. It's still there because you still got to battle some thoughts, but it's away from you. When you have to go back into the world is still there. Everything that caused it is there. All the triggers are there. And you got to be alone, and you got to sit with thoughts, and you got to sit with feelings, and you got to sit with everything. And that's the hardest thing, is sitting with stuff. Because eating disorder is a protection factor. It protects from the feelings. And that's what a lot of times that athletes maybe do. It's a protection thing. It's a drive. Because it's a lot of energy to do all these things. It's a lot of drive. It's a lot of things about control. It's like the world around you might be going to end, but you have this to control. This can you control. Everything else is like, but this you can control. And that's the hardest thing. But realizing every day, and realizing when I started coming back for treatment, realizing that my body is still having issues, and going to the doctor's appointments that I'm going to now, and realizing that my body is still not healing, or my body is still healing, is saying that I was sick. And having that, to say that, is a hard thing to come out of your mouth, because you fought tooth and nail with people of saying, I'm not sick because I don't look sick in your mind. And that was a hard thing of saying, I'm wrong. I was sick. And you know, like I didn't say that one of the things that was hard for when I was preparing for and talking about to this podcast was A, writing the story, which was a little hard to, like, you know, that's why a lot of times I struggled at the beginning was typing everything out. But I ended up looking back at some of the runs that I did, how many miles I ran, and thinking about how many calories I did consume, and thinking about all that different things. And you realize that how close things go. And again, I want to reiterate the misconception that you can look normal and be sick. And that's the thing that people have a hard time, because they think that you got to look so skinny to have that problem. Because a lot of time normal people can look fine and be in a normal weight, but still be sick. I didn't have a body fat that was like in the danger zone, but my protein, you know, my body was down, that I was, so then you take that misconception of that. They don't have to be that way.
Well, yeah. And I think it does go to body type, because 20 pounds off me and 20 pounds off Jeremy are two different animals altogether. Mm-hmm. And so 20 pounds off me, I'm going to look pretty good in my face and stomach, and I may be the unhealthy one. Now, 20 pounds for him would be a lot, and he would be very gaunt, but it's not a number.
No.
This could be another talk, and it'd be good for some coaches, but the scale, other than wrestling, and they have all kinds of rules for wrestling and weight management now, not that they follow them all, but the saying you need to be at this weight is just one of the issues. It's not the only. You know, again, you're this tall and you should be in this weight from a doctor's office is still bad. And we've got to get away from that, not just from a coaching standpoint, not just from a mom and dad standpoint, not just from a societal standpoint, but from a medical standpoint too. And you're right. You can look quote unquote good on the outside and be hell on the inside.
Well, I mean, because I had people that said to me that, hey, what diet are you on? What are you doing? What kind of workout are you doing?
You could have said nothing on diet and been absolutely honest, because you weren't eating.
Well, I mean, you know, I wanted to tell sometimes I wanted to be truthful and say, well, if you don't eat and you can.
I'm just watching what I eat.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the hard thing is the whole thing of battling out, you look good. I mean, I had the hard time of being used to new skin. You know, I had a hard time when I was in residential and I had to put on weight, and where I had to start the clothes that I brought to residential were starting to not fit. And that was making me very angry. And you have fights with your dietitian in residential. I'd pull on like war fights with her because I was not gonna gain weight. And when she kept on increasing my meal plan, I was like, you're not. I go, I don't know what number you think I need to be at, but I don't want to be at that. And you sit there and you have to sit with being your, when you have to sit with your stomach hurting so bad because you started putting on, that you had to eat a meal and your stomach hurts so bad because you started eating again, and you have to sit with that feeling. And that is hard. And I mean, I tell the story of when I went into residential and I haven't eaten a real meal, and they give you the sheet and they say, okay, here's the exchange book. Okay, make out what you want to eat. And I look at the diet tech and I'm like, what? I haven't eaten a real meal in like months. And having to remember what you like, and having to remember foods, and having to face foods, and that, and you know, having to look at foods for what nutritional value they are. I mean, and to look at foods that aren't, you know, undemonize some foods. that it's a hard time where you look at, I mean, I looked at a pizza slice sometimes and I said, you know, that was a very much a, like a fear food. And people hear fear food. Okay. It's a food that just like gives so much anxiety that is to undemonize some food. And because realizing at the end of the day, your body doesn't see it as, okay, you had a cheeseburger, you had a this kind of thing. It looks at, did I have enough starches? Did I have enough protein? Did I have enough dairy? Did I have enough fruits? Goes through all that. It doesn't see, your body doesn't recognize the actual food it actually had. It recognizes what nutrients it had. And that was the thing that I still have to re-go through my head every time I have a meal. And that's the hard thing. It's looking at the end of the day, do I have enough? Did I end with the amount of food? And when you don't have the hunger cues to remember to eat, that's another hard thing. Because that's a thing is like when your brain doesn't function to tell you when you're hungry and where you're full all the time, that's another hard thing that I've been doing. I've been out of treatment. I got out of residential in May. And, you know, it's end of October now. And to not have the feeling of having appetite or to feel full all the time is very, very, very much frustrating because I've been doing things right. And again, you wish you can flip the switch and have everything right. But realizing that you put your body through trauma is very hard. Very, very hard.
All right, we're in overtime, I know. So let me ask two things off of that. So you talked about the pain of your stomach with eating,
mm-hmm.
with putting food in there. Did you have a similar pain with not eating, or did the exercise take away that? So you're exercising, so you're not having these hunger drives, these hunger pains, or did you have them, but they were diminished, or did you have this same pain you had when you were putting food in your stomach?
I would say that it was putting more food in your stomach was worse. The pain that I was feeling during the time that I was restricting and running, I was actually feeling the not feeling like hunger. That was when I was restricting and running all the time. My eating disorder loved that. My eating disorder loved it.
So that was a relief almost.
That was a relief. The constipation and the feeling of like that kind of feeling, that sucked. But the feeling of putting that amount of food in your system where you got to sit with that and be okay with that and not want to and be okay with meeting your meal plan at the end of the day, that's something that like is a constant kind of like, okay, my body needs this. And even though I'm full,
I've got to give it to it.
I got to give it to it. And that's the thing that like, you have to like, is this my eating disorder or is this fullness? Because then you got to realize and kind of, you got to retrain your mind. And then you have to retrain your mind of, your brain gets hijacked with this. And it's like, it's a real, not real thing. Because it's real quickly when you don't have hunger cues to busy your way out of eating. And when you don't have that, you can busy your way really, really quick. And that's the same thing with kids that are suffering with this, is that they do so much different things every single day that in a lot of kids that they don't eat at the lunchroom. They don't. They have little time. They just go through it and they don't eat. And so they will, and especially it's an easy way for someone that's suffering with eating disorder in high school. And I've gone through treatment with a lot of kids in high school, is that when you're coming back from recovery, it's a hard, hard thing to come back to because you got to eat, but you got to eat around people that are not eating, but don't have an eating disorder, but you got to put nutrition in your body, but you got to see other people that are maybe not doing that. And so you got to be okay with that.
Are you getting the hunger cues back now? Are they there? Are they minimized? Are they not there at all?
They're faint.
Okay.
They're not
your normal hunger cue.
No, they're very, 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 very low. Very, very low.
But they are there. They are coming back slowly.
Mm, Yes and no.
Well, slowly is it, yeah.
Okay, I actually have to wrap this up.
Okay.
What?
And so, Catherine, if somebody, if say I was working with you or I was part of your, you know, outer circle kind of thing, what's something that I could do to continually encourage you I don't know if conquer this is, but to be proactive in dealing with your eating disorder?
I mean, I think the main thing is for anybody that, especially me and anybody that's suffering with this, is to be seen wholly and is to actually be seen with the eating disorder. Is that the eating disorder is a part of me, but to realize there are going to be good days and bad days, but then to be seen and to be an active listener. And that's the main thing, is to be an active listener and to not be brought in shame. And because mental health is so much of a shaming thing. And, you know, and I think that, like, I think this Saturday is a big, huge thing for me, is the National Eating Disorder Awareness Walk is this week, is finally walking, is people walking with, instead of walking, like, is walking with me. And that's the big thing, is walking with me and not, is asking questions. I would rather people ask questions and that kind of thing, and not be that I'm open to people asking stuff. And I guess that's the big thing.
Good. All right. Well, you know, me and Bubba are very vocal advocates of the AT's Care program. Obviously, Bubba is the rep here in Texas, and the guys that have gotten that started, it's a fantastic program. And Bubba, try and be brief. I know it's difficult for you, but how do you see AT's Care involved in situations like this?
It very much falls within it. It is a crisis, correct? So the difference is, in short, being brief, we could go debrief somebody that just dealt with the death of an athlete, a coworker, a loved one, and help them move forward down the road. I can't go debrief Catherine and help her move forward down the road. But the skills, you went through it, it's pretty much the same.
Right.
You're listening, you're encouraging, you're helping, but at some point she won't be ready for it. You got to go get help beyond me.
Yeah, you're stepping into the situation. You're listening. You're mm-hmm. using I statements, like Dr. McAdams said. So
right, but again, just like anything else, and is it? I can encourage her. Hey, we can talk more, but until she's ready to go deal with it, there's not a whole lot more we can do. But yes, it very much falls within that realm of AT's care.
Okay, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/eating disorder. One last thing is the school health. They give away $100 gift card every other month to a Sports Medicine Broadcast listener. So go to sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/school health. Again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/school health and register there. If you registered before, then go ahead and sign up again and be entered to win the $100 gift card there every other month to one of the listeners of the Sports Medicine Broadcast. sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/eating disorder. My guest, Catherine Lawrence, Bubba, appreciate it. Dr. Carrie McAdams, Jennifer Nagel also joining us. And that is a wrap.